From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Trump administration is moving ahead with a proposal to curb legal residency for those immigrants who would be eligible to obtain it, but who have used public assistance in the past, including Section 8 housing and food stamps. The Department of Homeland Security announced a new regulation recently on its website, claiming it's merely about enforcing an existing law that, quote, promotes self-sufficiency and protects American taxpayers. A spokesperson for the National Immigration Law Center said this is an attack on immigrant families and an attempt to make our immigration system a pay-to-play system where only the wealthy need apply. But of course, this is only the latest in a breathtaking array of attacks on undocumented and even documented immigrants that have escalated under the Trump administration. The details of the precarious lives that immigrants lead is rarely acknowledged or understood by non-immigrants. Now a new book explores the personal pain of navigating life as an undocumented immigrant. Jose Antonio Vargas is my guest. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, founder and CEO of the nonprofit group Define American. He's written for Time Magazine, San Francisco Chronicle, The New Yorker, and Washington Post. He's the winner of the Freedom to Write Award from Penn Center USA. He's also a filmmaker. His films include Documented, as well as White People, which was nominated for an Emmy. He now joins me to discuss his new book. It's called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Welcome to the program, Jose.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jose, those of us who are familiar with your story might recall reading your 2011 op-ed in the New York Times magazine, where you came out as an undocumented immigrant, a very brave and bold thing to do. Of course, that was the time of the Obama administration when sort of highlighting your situation sometimes protected you. These days, that's not actually the case. At the risk of having you retell the story for the nth time, I'm wondering if you can just share with us what led to you exposing yourself, who, you know, a person who's a very successful journalist, but saying out loud that you were undocumented.
Well, you know, actually, when I came out in 2011, I think that year President Obama had deported about 400,000 immigrants. And the whole point was, you know, why wasn't I one of them? Right. Like right. When I decided to do this, I was very aware that there is no protection. Right. And that, you know, all safety is Baldwin, as James Baldwin would say, is an illusion. And I had no illusion about kind of what protection or kind of safe haven I would receive, given that I'd made all this very public against the advice of immigration lawyers, many immigration lawyers. So the whole point is to kind of, How do we help take this issue out of this Mexican border wall box that many people, including us in the news media, with you an exception to that, have locked it in, right? Like Trump would not have been elected president if more Americans knew what immigration really is about, right? And you made up a really interesting point there in your introduction that this is an administration that doesn't care about the distinction between documented and undocumented immigrants. They just don't want any immigrants, right? And I think that's something that we have to really face, that there is no longer that distinction. And yet we have a news media ecosystem that doesn't really understand what this issue is about, doesn't understand the processes of this issue. And my writing this book, my whole goal was, how do we explain to people, especially to me even, like what has been the emotional cost of all of this? What does this feel like, having to live a life like this for the past 25 years of my being in this country?
So you were 12 when you came to the United States. Your mother sent you here to the US, and you didn't actually quite discover that you were undocumented until quite a bit later. The struggle that you went through settling in and sort of having that culture shock that all new immigrants face, whether you have papers or not, is also part of that story. Give us a sense of what life was like before you knew you were undocumented, but when you were just struggling to fit in as an immigrant kid in an American school.
Yeah, so that was about 4 years. I came here when I was 12, and I didn't find that I was undocumented until I was 16. And you know, in the book, I actually ended up telling the story of, for me, the seminal moment of my confusion was the O.J. Simpson trial.
Wow.
Like, during, because my teacher, Mrs. Wakefield, stopped the class and turned on the radio so everybody in class could listen to the verdict. I was in seventh grade at the time of Creighton Middle School in Mountain View, where Google is at. But, you know, I was there. We were there before Google was there. And I'll never forget. So my school actually was a third Asian, a third white, and a third Latino, with some black people, black students, not many. And what was interesting was when the verdict was announced, the white students reacted one way, the black students reacted another way, and the majority of the people in the room, which were more Asian and Latino students, looked at each other going like, which side do we go, right? Do we go white? Do we go black? I would argue that that's still the case in America today. Like, we talk about America, you know, mainstream, quote unquote, America from a very black and white binary. Right, it's so rare that we even talk about anti-blackness in immigrant communities, in Asian and Latino immigrant communities. Right, it's so rare that we talk about the fact that many, a part of the immigrant experience in this country, particularly if you're Asian, or you know, or Latino, is this idea of passing. That was a seminal moment for me because it meant that someone like me was Filipino. Right, I look Asian. My name is very Spanish, just because of Spanish colonialism. To figure out where do I fit in the black and white binary, in this dynamic. And actually, for me, the moment I found out that I was here illegally, the first thing I thought of to do was to get rid of my Tagalog accent, which is really thick. And that meant sounding like Bill Moyers in NPR, and also sounding like, you know, Ice Cube, and listening to hip hop CDs, right? I had to sound white and black just so I could pass.
So then you found out at 16 that you were undocumented, and suddenly the struggle, I imagine, became even more complex. The struggle to fit in as an immigrant kid, and then to try to figure out what to do with this knowledge that you are in this country without papers, which puts you at a great legal risk.
And the blessing there was I found journalism. I come from a family of kind of workers that writing was not at all, a family of kind of laborers, right? Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a security guard. My grandmother was a food server. They were farmers in the Philippines. So there were no writers in the family. Like, college was not even something that we even really thought about. But I found out that when you write a news article, your name gets to be on the story, your byline. And I figured that if I didn't have the right papers, at least my name could be on the newspaper. I'll never forget when my grandmother actually saw my name in the paper. She screamed out loud and she said, you know, you're supposed to be hiding. Like, why is your name on the paper? So that was my own way of kind of claiming my own independence from them.
So this notion that your family asked you or expected of you, which is that you have to be hiding, you know, for those of us who haven't had to worry about that, what is the impact that that has on a young person in America? And you've met now hundreds of undocumented immigrants in the United States. That fear is something that has a psychological impact on how one sees oneself in the country, but also how one views oneself, you know, within your own head.
As much as we talk about immigrant reform, and as much as we talk about all these policies, I think we have completely lost of what the emotional toll is of all of this, right? Again, like, what does that feel like? There's a mental health crisis facing immigrant communities across this country. And when I say immigrant communities, because you can't really separate the undocumented population from the documented population. I was talking to a young man a few months ago who is a U.S. citizen, but whose mom is undocumented, right? So it's a mixed status family. And this young man was saying to me that he's so frustrated that he seems more worried for his mom than his mom is worried for herself. Hmm. And apparently the mom said to him, Mijo, right? Mijo, son in Spanish, God has been hiding me for 21 years. he will continue to hide me. And just distress on the young man's face as he was saying this, you know, and trying to understand kind of what his mom has been living with for 21 years. So that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to understand what the cost of all of this for me has been, right? Like, the book is structured in three parts, which is kind of the state of being that I found myself in: lying, passing, and hiding, right? Those are the three things that I've done to continue to be in this country without documents. I've lied, I've tried to pass, and I was hiding in plain sight. I didn't realize that all that time, I wasn't just hiding from the government. I was actually hiding from myself, right? In terms of how I am as a person and how I have really, you know, real trouble with relationships and have trouble with kind of sitting down and sitting still. I'm always on the run as if someone's trying to catch me. I'm trying to go somewhere. I don't know where I'm going, right? And you said that, quote unquote, I'm successful. Yeah, the resume looks good. But as a person, I've never felt safe. And that was hard to admit to myself. You know, that again, you know, Baldwin said, all safety is an illusion. I didn't really realize that until I wrote this book.
What impact did it have on your life to expose yourself as an undocumented immigrant in 2011? Was that somewhat freeing?
Oh, yeah, it was freeing because I felt like, I don't know if you've read The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. I felt like I was like living that version of something. I was just going to, I'm surprised I never screamed it out loud. I remember once I was interviewing Sarah Palin and, you know, I wanted to say it to her, but I didn't. I was a political reporter at The Washington Post. There were many times I remember I was profiling Mark Zuckerberg for The New Yorker and I was interviewing him in Palo Alto and I almost said it to him. I almost just said, oh, you know, FYI, I'm that. But I didn't. I was such a coward, you know, all those years. So that was freeing. But what I did not anticipate was what the cost of the publicness of this meant in terms of what people expect of you, right? I mean, I'm used to kind of the anti-immigrant kind of trolls that like go on my social media and tell me that I have to leave and tell me that they want to deport me. I'm used to all of that. I wasn't particularly prepared to deal with the pressure from the left and progressives that, you know, who say that I'm not radical enough, that I'm too assimilationist. You know, in the book, I wrote about an episode in which an undocumented day laborer said to me, this is pretty early on, like 2012, I think it was right after I was on the cover of Time magazine with other undocumented people. He said to me, you can't represent us, you're too successful. And I said to him, I'm not sure he heard me. I said to him, you know, look, I can't represent anybody else but myself. And then he said under his breath, he probably didn't want me to hear it. He said, you're not even Mexican.
Oh.
And now I, you know, as a journalist, you know, it's kind of part of my training, right? I wanted to understand where that was coming from. I wanted to understand why he said that. But at the same time, I'm also a human being and I just felt really hurt by it, you know, because I, from where I'm standing, I've always had to prove myself to a lot of people at, you know, at the Washington Post, at these prestigious news organizations that I was at, that I was worthy enough of being in the room, right? They were like, who is this kid? He didn't even go to an Ivy League school, right? I was always trying to prove myself to like other journalists that I was worthy. And then I come out as undocumented and I now have to prove myself to other activists who, you know, question my motive or question why I was doing this. You know, someone actually said to me that maybe I was using this for my success. I said, my career was doing just fine. And, you know, at the rate I was going, I was hoping to be the editor of a major newspaper or a magazine that towards. And I kind of, you know, I knew that the moment I did this, that would be out of the table. That would be out of the table. Because I would be considered an activist or, you know, an advocate that had an agenda. And my career was the only thing I had. My journalism career was the only thing I had. So it was, that was really painful, like dealing with, you know, being in this position where you're never enough, even for the people whose circumstances you share.
Wow. So the moment where you came out was freeing, but also telling. It added a new dimension to your life. And then, of course, 2016, 5 years after you have declared you're an undocumented immigrant, we have Trump's America, where people like you who've been passing and lying, as you've said, this was obviously a continuation of an earlier era under Obama, but of course, it has been so much more than that too, right? What has the last year and a half been like for yourself and for undocumented immigrants? I can only imagine that that pain and trauma you're talking about has now skyrocketed.
Well, I mean, I think, we've been trying to figure out what the worst case scenario is, and that's what we're living through. We're living through the worst case scenario. And again, Trump is just the manifestation of every nonsensical, ineffective, inhumane immigration policy we've had in this country since the 90s, after the Reagan amnesty program, right? So, but this is definitely the worst time. I have to say, for me personally, what happened was after the election, I was living in an apartment building in downtown LA. I was there for about 2 years. And the building manager, who's been very supportive of my work, whenever he sees me on Fox News, he would send me like a text saying, "Hey, that was a good job." He texted me a few weeks after the election and he said, "Hey, it may be a good idea for you to move out of the building. We're not sure what we would do if I showed up."
So he basically felt like he couldn't protect you.
I'm sorry,
He
can you
felt
repeat
like
that?
he
What was that?
couldn't pro he felt like he couldn't protect you
Yeah.
from ICE.
And you could just sense kind of the confusion. Even, after he texted me, I met up with him in person, and I could sense that he was just kind of like, "Look, like this is a tough situation." And so I moved out of the apartment. This was February 2017. I put everything I own in storage. And then I took kind of all the really important stuff, like my high school diploma. Probably my most prized possession is my high school diploma. My diploma, kind of every paper that I've collected, like my newspaper clips. It's all in my grandmother's garage in Mountain View, and I've been living without a place since. So I actually wrote the book while kind of I've been, without a place. So I wrote it while staying in Airbnbs, hotel rooms where I'm at right now. I'm staying with some friends in their spare bedrooms or their living room. So that was the process of actually even writing the book, was
So what you were saying, what you were
that
saying
sense of displacement.
earlier about people from the left saying that you were too successful and now you don't have a place to live.
Yeah, but that was I chose that. I mean, if I wanted to, I could, but it's not, I don't know. I felt like I had to really understand why I am the way that I am, why I've never felt safe. So for me, it's kind of this very internal, interior process that frankly I did not want to do. But I've never had therapy before. I think people of color sometimes have a hard time fighting against the stigma of therapy. And this book is like the best therapy I could have given myself. I make so much more sense to myself now after writing this book. Now I understand why I am the way that I am. So that's been kind of the gift, right? And I hope that the book, for people who have read it so far, I mean, thankfully people are posting it on social media. Kind of again getting into the psychology of this, and trying to get to some understanding of what that is.
So, Jose, your experience, of course, while very unique to you, I'm sure shares many similarities with the experiences of the millions of people in this country that live as undocumented immigrants, and even those today that are under attack as documented immigrants or people who might have the right things in place to apply for residency or apply for citizenship, and with the Trump administration even trying to undo that. We have news now that the Trump administration is starting to revoke the citizenship of people who have some people have become naturalized citizens, which is also unheard of. So these stories are all over this country, because of course, undocumented people, immigrants live all around us. Why don't we hear more about them? Why don't we see more about them? And I know you're involved in sort of getting Hollywood also to take on the stories of undocumented immigrants, right?
We have really a crisis in this country when it comes to how we talk about immigrants, documented and undocumented. We have a news media ecosystem, and I'm saying this, I'm sad to say this because, you know, I will always be a journalist. That's been my identity since I was a kid. And how irresponsible in general, with some exceptions, how irresponsible the news media has been on this issue. I can't even really recall a time when the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR, it's been very rare that they have even acknowledged the fact that undocumented immigrants pay taxes and Social Security, billions of dollars, right? It's just, we have all kind of, for the most part, the news media has internalized and has sold the narrative that Donald Trump won on, which is that immigrants don't contribute to America, right? But in addition to that, there's this feeling that goes beyond facts, right? That the American people, many working class American people, feel under attack, right? And they can't even describe what that is. I know this because I've been traveling around the country, and that's why for us at Define American, it's not enough that the news media is, you know, an industry that we challenge. It's also important for us, you know, that the television shows and the movies that you watch. We made a film for MTV called White People. I don't know if you saw
Yeah.
that 3 years ago. I made a documentary for
It was
MTV,
nominated for an
and
Emmy, right?
yes, it was. I was really proud of that. But you know, in the film, when after we did the film, MTV did a study that was surprising to me because I've grown up in cities my entire life, and so the study said that 75% of white people live in predominantly white towns and cities. I didn't know that. And that 90% of white people have predominantly white friends, meaning the only time a person of color would enter the consciousness of a white person who lives in a predominantly white town who has predominantly white friends is what? The news media they consume and the television shows and the movies that they watch, right? So we have become the stories we tell. So it's really important for us at a time like this, and this is taking off the page of the LGBT rights movement. Before there was same-sex marriage, right? Before we saw kind of equality under the law when it comes to LGBTQ people in this country, it was television shows. It was Ellen on the cover of Time magazine. It was Will and Grace is the number one show on television, right? I still have whiplash about trans representation. I remember when I was, you know, in college, like trans issues were not at all in the mainstream. And now because of Laverne Cox, Janet Mock, Gina Dosero, and many other trans women of color, now we have a better understanding of the humanity of trans people, right? I'm sad to say as a gay man that we live in a country where being homophobic is no longer culturally acceptable, but being anti-immigrant is not only culturally acceptable, you win the White House. That's a
Right.
cultural conversation. We are amidst a culture war, right? And of course, legal services for immigrants are important. Of course, trying to figure out how we can provide driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants is important. Of course, trying to figure out what immigration reform may even look like. We got to talk about that. But unless people understand that we're actually talking about human beings, that immigration now is what it's always been about, which is about families and what families do for each other, until we actually change the culture, the politics is not going to change.
Jose, you're going to be speaking Tuesday evening, September 25th, at an event in Los Angeles. It's going to be at the Bovard Auditorium on the campus of USC. Event starts at 7:30 p.m. We'll put information about that on our website. Is this why you've written your book and are sharing your story around the country on your book tour? Because the more of these stories we hear, the more we humanize our fellow immigrants. The more successful we are at winning this culture war. And as the stories that you've shared earlier, the issues you've shared earlier, especially about LGBTQ Americans, shows culture wars are winnable.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for us, you know, I mean, I'm only one story, right? And so I think we need multiple stories as complex as possible, right? So that's why at Define America, when you go to our website, we house like the largest collection of undocumented stories online of people who have shared their stories with us. And we use those stories, by the way, when we go to writers' rooms in Hollywood, when we say, oh, can you make that an undocumented Indian character instead? Does she have to be Mexican? Can you make that an undocumented Nigerian character, right? You know, how that happened actually is there's a show called Superstore, a really great show on NBC, and they introduce a character who's Filipino and who's gay. So clearly it had something in common with that character.
I love that show. That's a great show.
It's a great show. And then we found out when we spoke to the producers that they wanted to make that character, Nico Santos's character on the show, undocumented. And then they said, oh yeah, we'll make him legal in the next episode or something like that. Hmm. And we're like, how are you going to do that?
What mechanism exists for that, that can happen so fast? Because I'm sure you'd like to know.
Exactly. But again, these are well-meaning, you know, people that want to do the right thing, but they didn't know that there is no line. There is no process. Isn't that incredible? As much as we talk about this issue, even people who are on our side doesn't know that there's no process and that there's no easy line, that immigration is not one size fits all, that race, class, all of that matters when it comes to this issue. So we have a lot of educating to do, but thankfully the LGBT rights movement has done this already and continues to do it. And so we're taking kind of a page from what they've done. And, you know, as a member of the LGBTQ community, I think it's also important that we recognize that these issues intersect, right? Like, people's lives are complicated. We're not just one thing.
And of course, it's not to suggest when I say we won the culture war on LGBTQ issues that community is perfectly safe, but certainly has a broader base of support in the United States than we've ever had before. So that's success compared to the way it was even 10 years ago. And may we speak in 10 years, Jose, and talk about winning the culture war on immigration and immigrants. I want to thank you so much for joining us. I know you're speaking at a number of events around the country, including the one Tuesday night at USC, 7:30 p.m. at Bovard Auditorium. It's hosted by Skylight Books and sponsored by our radio station, KPFK. What's a website where people can find out where else you're speaking?
Please go to joseantoniovargas.com.
That's joseantoniovargas.com. Well, and we'll post a link to that from our website. Jose, good luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your story so beautifully.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Jose Antonio Vargas. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, founder and CEO of the nonprofit group Define American. He's a filmmaker and a writer. We've been discussing his new book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.